Hello everyone and welcome to Cricket Unfiltered, the News Corp Cricket Podcast. I'm your host Andrew Mensel and I am in cricket podcast heaven. I'm on location at Hurstville Oval. I've got two cricket journalists locked in the mobile studio, i.e. my car, and we are about to wrap up all the cricket news. Now let me welcome to the show Peter Lawler. Peter, how are you?
Not bad, Andrew, but if this is heaven, I'm going to stop going to church, mate.
Look, I'm a cricket tragic, so this is heaven for me. And you're the chief cricket writer for The Australian. Great to have you on the show for the first time.
Thank you for having me on. It's an honour to be here, especially with the other bloke in the back seat.
And the other bloke locked in the studio is returning for his second appearance on Cricket Unfiltered, Ben Horne, chief cricket writer for the Daily Telegraph in Sydney. How are you, Ben?
I'm good, thanks, man. I'm struggling to find the seatbelt at the moment, but, you know, hopefully we don't need it anyway. But, yeah, this is a very interesting location for a podcast.
Well, the listeners need to strap themselves in because they are in for one wild cricket ride. We've been watching all the Test contenders battle it out at Hurstville Oval. We've been seeing Pat Howard and Mark Waugh walk around, so we had to go and find a quiet place where they wouldn't hear us talk about the selection meeting. So here we are. And we're going to go through all the contenders for the Aussie spot. We're also going to have a chat about the English team, wrap up the cricket news. And then to end this show, I've got two fantastic interviews with two opening batsmen, Nicole Bolton, the Australian women's opener, and Travis Dean, the young Victorian opener. So that's both to come. But let's get into the battle for the number six spot in the Australian cricket team. I think on the weekend we saw a name, you know, all of a sudden come out of the blue, Jake Lehman. So I guess I'll start with you, Pete. Can you see Jake Lehman being picked for Australia?
Yes, but I can't see him being picked for the first test in Brisbane. Kid's a good bat. Guess what, he's got five centuries, has he?
Six, I think.
That was his sixth century, yeah. No, I think it'd be very unlikely that he will get the number six spot. But watch that space. He's a very talented young bloke. Yeah,
well, I mean, his record just keeps getting better. I mean, he might not look that flash sometimes, but 600s and averages over 40 and in a pretty short space of time. So they wanted hundreds and wanted big runs, and so far he's the only person that's delivered that.
And you've already given him a nickname, haven't you, Ben?
Yes, Sob.
Son of Boof.
Yeah.
It's very good, isn't it? Yeah. So we're looking, it could be a sob story, mate. Yes.
But he's averaging over 40 in first-class cricket. He's made six centuries, so he's certainly someone that, you know, could come into contention. If he scores runs in the next Shield game, wow, he's going to be mounting a pretty special case.
Yeah, I suppose. Well, I mean, the thing is, and there's been some confusion around it, hasn't there, about when the selectors are actually picking the side. Steve Smith was adamant that it was at the end of this Shield game, but it's not. It's halfway through the next one. So he's got two more innings in front of him, possibly. Yes.
And the rain's coming down in our mobile studio, but we'll forge ahead. So next one, next contender, we've got Hilton Cartwright. Now, Hilton Cartwright, I'm not sure his technique is ready for Test cricket.
As a bowler?
As a batsman, Hilton Cartwright.
Yeah, well, I'm no great judge of techniques, but he's got good numbers, hasn't he, Hilton Cartwright?
He's bowled a lot though.
That ball that comes back into him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
I think it was LBW this game, but it was the same problem, the ball coming back in. But look, he's got a first class average of 50, and people that you talk to around Australian cricket, I'm not sure whether you talk to the same people, Pete, but his name pretty regularly comes up in the top two or three batsmen around the country as far as these people from different states believe. And that's not just WA people. He's pretty highly regarded. And, you know, in the event, with no one really scoring runs, I think it's going to take something pretty special to knock him off the perch.
Yeah, and look, if Sheffield Shield does still count, an average of 50 in Sheffield Shield is as good as they've got to go on. I mean, all the rest around 40s, or they're people who haven't been in the game long enough to fail. Yeah,
that's right. And, you know, he's played two test matches so far, hasn't set the world on fire, but also hasn't struggled. And Australia have won both of those test matches. So if you're interested in giving a guy a sustained go, he probably deserves one.
Yeah, I think so. Under the new selection policy, I think you've just got to lock him in. I reckon this whole, look, it's there to grab, you know, go out there, bat, prove yourself and you'll get yourself in a test side just hasn't worked, has it?
Mm.
It's really blown up in their face. Here we are halfway through the second round of Shields and we've got three centuries. One from Usman Khawaja, that's reassuring, but nothing more. One's from Jake Lehman, I think that shows some potential down the track. And one is from
Marcus Harris.
Marcus Harris, yeah.
Who's got a half-decent little record, but I think he still averages around 30, so he's a long way away from putting his name up for test selection, I would have thought. So, yeah, there's a problem. As we touched on at the possibly in our warm-up, Cameron Bancroft's played a very nice innings here at Hurstville Oval. 76 not out, carried his bat from start to finish. Only a Mitchell Starc hat-trick probably stopped him from making 100. So he's an interesting case. His average is probably not where it should be. It's 35, but he does have 10 first-class hundreds to his name, and with his wicket-keeping skills, he ticks a few boxes, I guess, but it just depends in what light they view him.
Yeah, look, 76 not out in those conditions against the Australian Test attack. You've got to rate that really highly. So I think Justin Lang has thrown a little wobbly into the mix there, picking him and giving him the gloves in this game. Mm. So.
Well, it's interesting. He kept in the JLT One Day Cup and did quite well.
And he's kept for Australia in a T20.
He has. So. But this is only his second match keeping in a Shield game. So, I mean, that's telling.
Yeah.
He didn't keep in the first match. So why he was given the gloves for this game, I'm not quite sure. But that would be a punt, I think, to give him the gloves for Australia. But who knows? Maybe he's a contender for six or to open because he's got a few skills.
Yeah, yeah. I think it'd be ridiculous to put him in as a keeper on the back of two first-class games like that. You've really got to have miles. This is what all the keepers say. You've got to have the miles in your legs. And you've particularly got to have them in your legs at Shield cricket. And then it's another step up, isn't it? You've got a fifth day. Shield cricket's a lot less pressure in the eyes on you and that sort of department. So it's a really significant shift to go from that to Test cricket. And so he's well behind the eight ball on that.
Yeah, look, I agree with Pete. I think Neville is the firm favourite. And I thought a telling quote from Steve Smith the other day was Neville's runs at the end of last season when he got dropped haven't been forgotten. He got dropped in controversial circumstances, but went back and made 300s at Shield level last season. So that's a fair rap on a guy who's willing to put the work in.
I think what you've been saying about Kerry for a couple of weeks now is he had to make 100, didn't he, to get into the Test team, and he hasn't done it. So I'd be stunned if he pulls on the gloves in Brisbane.
Yeah.
What about Matt Renshaw? Now, seemingly a certain pick for the Gabba Test, but now there seems to be increasing pressure for him to score runs.
Yeah, look, I think the pressure in some ways is justified, but I think it's a bit premature, personally. I mean, if we see Matt Renshaw struggle in the first two Test matches, depending on how Australia go in those two Test matches, I could accept a scenario where he was being put under the pump, but I think it's grossly unfair that he would be considered in strife for the first Test. I just think that's a pretty harsh way of looking at what he's contributed over the last 12 months. So it'll be interesting to see whether that's a tactic or whether it's genuine pressure.
Yeah. I think it's unfortunate that this talks around, and I wonder if it's got in his head a little bit, because he hasn't made Shield runs yet. He's batting as we speak, isn't he, up there? They're chasing about 150 runs, so hopefully he pushes on and does that. He started very slowly, but that's his style. I think his strike rate's about 17 to lunch.
I mean, it's funny how we, we get quite bullish very quickly in Australian cricket, because when he first came into the side, if you remember his debut in Adelaide, I mean, he only made a handful of runs, but he stayed out there for a couple of hours. And whilst that might not be pretty, at the time, that was exactly what the doctor ordered, because we were so used to this procession of wickets falling early. And look, I think that he's, he needs to be able to work the singles and turn the strike over, but I think his style complements Warner's well. And, we can't have a team of six dashes, because we've seen what happens when that occurs. So, he does need to become a better batsman, there's no doubt about that, but he got picked as a 19-year-old, and I reckon you've got to give him a pat on the back for what he's done so far.
Lock him in.
Well, those two, lock him in. Now, before we move on from the Aussie contender discussion, just one quick question. Steve Smith came out and answered claims that he's been picking his mates in the Test side. What do you make of all this? Is there some problem there with Steve Smith, or is it just a bit of paper talk?
Well, it's... I've never perceived it as him picking his mates. I mean, I'm sure Steve Smith has a lot of mates in Australian cricket and many of them aren't playing for Australia. I guess the question is whether you're comfortable with him having such a big influence over who gets picked in the team. That's the question. I don't think there's any... There should be any doubt about Steve Smith's integrity with, you know, the reasons why he pushes people forward. But
look,
we had a situation 12 months ago where Australian cricket fell apart and people like Ian Chappell and Michael Clarke were calling for Steve Smith to have more of a say because it's his team and whoever, you know, if they win or lose, it goes on his name. So in that sense, I think that there was a widespread call for Smith to have more justification, and I guess the question is now, do you think they should revise that?
No, I think it's fair enough, isn't it? Because you know, he's going to be judged on the result, so he should have some say in selection.
Yeah, and look, a lot of this needs to be fed through or seen through a window of interstate rivalry too, doesn't it? I think, you know,
well, there's that perception about how many New South Wales players make the side, I guess.
Almost all of them.
I think one example that shows that hasn't necessarily been Smith's motivation is, you know, he was a huge supporter of Matt Wade. I mean, if you read his book, he's basically devoted an entire page to why he wanted Matt Wade, and he's a Victorian/Tasmanian. So
yeah, well, that's the area that gets a lot of debate, isn't it? Does he want Matt Wade because Matt Wade sledges? But I think he put it in better terms the other day, didn't he? It's that motivational presence, and I do think that's been a fair knock on Pete Neville. Pete Neville is the best gloveman in the country. He's an neatest, and I think he's up there as the best batsman too, with Matt Wade, or, you know, depending on what sort of form they're in. But Pete is a quiet keeper, and a keeper's your drummer in the band. He's your rhythm section. He's got to keep. It's his job to keep the boys on their toes late in the day and that sort of business. And he's never been vocal on that front. He's never been a motivator. He's been more self-contained, and that's not what Australia want in their wicket keepers. And that's what Smithy said to him, isn't it? So I think I heard his voice out there yesterday. I'm being a little bit sarcastic because he's still very quiet.
You probably heard the guy who was mowing his lawn in this house here as well. But
all right, so that is the wrap up of the Aussie contenders. So we've circled around Cartwright and Neville as being, you know, pretty close to being in that Australian side. But stay tuned because the race is hotting up. But now, guys, I think we've spent a lot of time on the last podcast and this one talking about the Aussies. But I'd like to talk a little bit about the Pommies because they've arrived in Australia and I think a lot of people don't really know what to make of this squad. But let's first start with the English tour policy. Now, Bayliss has explained that there will be no curfews and no alcohol bans, and the players have sat down and worked out their own rules. Well, isn't this the thing that got them in trouble in the first place with Ben Stokes when they let the players run the show? I don't know, maybe they should have come in a bit harder for this tour.
It's an interesting question, but I think the person who had been causing problems for some time for England was Ben Stokes. So I don't think there was a problem with the squad in general, you know, getting out and disgracing themselves. I think it was he who had a few indiscretions. There was a bit of talk that he was out till the very wee hours before a test match in Manchester. So,
a la Andrew Simons.
Yeah, look, I think you go into dangerous territory when you start slapping curfews down and all that kind of thing. And, you know, you do have to trust the players to behave themselves and make correct decisions, and then if they don't, that's when you throw the book at them. I mean, I think the way they need to deal with this is to ban Ben Stokes from coming here and send a message, not by banning everyone else's fun.
Yeah, it's always been an issue, isn't it, where to draw the line. I mean, 06-07, Andrew Flintoff was out on the bending the elbow almost every night. I mean, he was depressed. Well, it was quite an issue on that tour. Him and Steve Harmison were a party of two every night. Well, probably not every night. Things get exaggerated. There's just got to be common sense, doesn't there? Common sense. If you're out at 2 a.m., you're letting the side down, basically, aren't you? Unless, you know, maybe that's allowed after a big win.
Or a day-night test.
Yeah, not when you've got a bloody a day-night test, yeah. Except they have it in Adelaide, which closes at 6 p.m, so there's no danger of getting...
There's nowhere to go afterwards.
There's only strip clubs. Yeah, there's nothing else. You can't get anything to eat or drink anywhere.
And, I mean, I think that we've covered a fair bit of cricket now, Pete, and, I mean, the way that modern cricket is these days and how professional it is, I mean, you just don't see players out drinking when they shouldn't be. I mean, yeah, like, you know, there might be celebrations after a win. If there's, a you know, players who aren't participating in the test, they might be out. But it's not like these guys go overseas and spend every night in the pub. I mean, it's not the 1980s anymore. So it's not like a huge issue. I guess it's you just have to make these players aware what the expectations are on those occasional nights when they do go out.
It's interesting in England that you can actually go out and be anonymous, isn't it? That the two guys involved in the fight weren't aware of the situation because cricket was so far off their radar. Mm. Wouldn't happen here.
No.
Be on you straight away.
Probably wouldn't happen to a footballer in England either.
Although those two guys obviously don't read the local paper, I wouldn't have thought, because I think it was probably out there a bit.
Well, it was kind of odd, wasn't it? Now, how could it be, you know, it seemed to be a pretty big story out here, but these two blokes didn't know anything about it.
All right, so let's get to know this English squad, because I think that within this English squad, there's some really strong match winners in there, and people are writing England off, but if these, and I've got six players to highlight, if they have good summers, then Australia could be in real trouble. The first one is Alastair Cook. He's only 370 runs away from 12,000 test runs. And in the last two years, he's averaged almost 42. He's now free from the captaincy. Mm. So he is someone to watch.
Cookie, yeah, he's an outstanding player. And it'll be interesting to see what the, you know, not having the captaincy means for him. I mean, that's a fair burden to carry around, especially the last time he was here and they were getting towed up. So, yeah, I'm interested to see how Alastair Cook goes without that responsibility on his shoulders.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you've got to think, this is his last tour, isn't it? I get a bad...
Perhaps. He's got 10 years. He's only, what, 32 or something?
Is he 32,
is
he?
He's young. He could go on for ages.
He looks young.
God. He bats old, doesn't he? Yeah. No, he's an outstanding batsman, and he beat Australia almost single-handedly a couple of tours back. So it will be interesting to see. They need to get into him early. I hate to sound like... Botham here. What did Botham's
bounce him out?
No, Botham's recipe for beating Australia in the Ashes. It was a headline yesterday. Get Steve Smith and David Warner out early. Who'd have thought of that, eh? So here's my plan for beating England in the Ashes. Get Alistair Cook out early. Yeah.
And Joe Root. And then
Joe Root too. Yeah,
the next match winner is Joe Root, because I don't think Australians have yet to see the best of him at Test cricket. But I think Joe Root, I mean, he averages over 50 in Test cricket quite comfortably, but I think his strength is, if he comes in and England's in trouble, he tends to counter-attack. And that's the sort of thing that can get Australian attacks into trouble. He's aggressive, he's got a good head on his shoulder, so I think Joe Root's really, he's danger man, number one.
It's good when it comes off, but his strength's his weakness when it fails, and it's the weakness of that team that they back themselves to sort of belt their way out of trouble, and they've acknowledged that too. Although I think they've looked for a few more sort of, well, they're looking for somebody a bit more solid around the middle order, aren't they? Outstanding batsman. It got dropped here last time too. That's interesting, because a bloke like him have, you know, I mean, all Test cricketers have a lot of professional pride, but Joe Root's an outstanding competitor. I think he's one of the best competitors in world cricket today. And he'll want to prove that he can do it in Australia, because he didn't get the chance last time.
Yeah, look, this might sound like a fairly obvious statement, but I think that England can't win the Ashes in the first Test, but they can lose it. I mean, if Australia completely destroy them in Brisbane like they did last time, and Ben Stokes isn't here, I just can't see any way back for England. But if they fight and compete in Brisbane, then this is an Australian side that, you know, we'll find out what they're made of. So this is absolutely critical, this first Test for England, because I think if they don't aim up, they'll fall off the cliff.
Well, the doom and gloom Australian merchants are saying that Adelaide's the wobbly now. So, you know, like, that will, you know, England could come back into it in Adelaide, you know, but you're right, Australia has to win that Test match. They can't even afford a draw, really, because you know, you don't want to go in level pegging with England in Adelaide, do you? Mm. Because you really think that's going to bring England's bowlers back into it.
That's, yeah, that, especially for Jimmy Anderson, talking about Cook possibly being on his last tour. I mean, this is 100% James Anderson's last tour, and the jury's out on whether he has the pace anymore, I suppose, to compete on these pitches out here. But Adelaide is the one match where it doesn't really matter. If he, you know, we see how that pink ball hoops around, and yeah, that is going to be very interesting cricket.
Well, one of those match winners I had here is James Anderson, and you know, you talk about his age, he's coming off a career year. He took almost 40 wickets at 14 in the home English summer.
He's Mitchell Johnson style,
yeah,
isn't
he's in top form. So you know, if he can get conditions that favour him in a couple of games or even a couple of sessions, we saw what he could do over in England last year. So yeah, I think James Anderson's one to watch. The other one is the Aussie nemesis, Stuart Broad. He just seems to come through for England when Australia least want him to, I guess. You know, Trent Bridge last year, the 2009 Ashes in the fifth test. He's just a genuine match winner. And, you know, if Anderson and Broad get some kind of rhythm going together, our top order could be under the pump.
Yeah, I mean, Broad's your classic Ashes villain, isn't he? And he thrives on it. So he's an outstanding player. And I don't think age is so much a factor for him because he's just got it in him. There's no question that Jimmy Anderson's one of the best bowlers we've seen in this generation, but he's a guy that clearly relies a lot on his ability to swing the ball, and at many of these grounds in Australia, that window closes pretty quickly.
Yeah, very early with that ball.
All right, two more match winners for England that I want to touch on. Johnny Bairstow, last year in 2016 was his career year so far. He scored all his three test tons, and he's averaging almost 60 last year. If he has the gloves in this Ashes tour and comes in down the order, it gives England a lot of depth in their batting lineup.
Yeah, well, that's the one thing that they do have, don't they, with him and Moeen Ali down there towards the bottom end. They're strong down that, perhaps stronger at the bottom than the middle,
yeah,
in a way. Yeah, outstanding cricketer. I'm looking forward to seeing him. Him and Stokes would have made a fearsome sort of
I mean, it's issue. Funny, like, yeah. I mean, we don't watch enough of their team to know, but, I mean, I just can't understand how Moeen Ali can't get a promotion up the batting order. I mean, every time I see him play, he's bailing him out of trouble. He doesn't look like he's worried. It's like they don't want to ruin that recipe, but it's I'd rather have him up top and maybe not be five down for
well,
90 and have him
at least have it at five or six.
Yeah.
But Moeen Ali has an amazing record. Australians would love a player like him. He scored five test hundreds and taken 4 5 wicket hauls. I mean, that's a very strong all-round record. I mean, Australia would give anything for someone like that.
Yeah, but he's in the sick bay at the moment. He's got a side strain. That's a worry. Mm. Yeah, they're playing it down, but you know, side strains are real issues for...
So they're the big six match winners I have for England. As I said, if they fire, I think they can put real pressure on the Australian side. Now, Ben and Peter, I'm going to let you go in a minute, but before we go, I just want to look ahead to the Women's Day-Night Ashes Test coming up in Sydney this week. Just in terms of the historic nature of the game, it's the first ever Ashes Day-Night Test at a beautiful ground. What are you guys expecting from the event?
Oh, look, I'm feeling really positive about it. It's just the advances that have happened in women's cricket in the last couple of seasons are outstanding. And, you know, often criticise Cricket Australia, but they seem to have got this right, haven't they? The professionalisation of women's cricket, led by New South Wales, I might add, who had their women well ahead in that race. Tickets are $10 for adults, $5 for kids. I think they really got their fingers crossed that they can actually sell the ground out. Have you seen ticket sales, Ben?
Yeah, I think they're going pretty well. I'm not sure about a sellout. I mean, it is a fairly big ground. I mean, the Great North Sydney Bears used to get 14,000, 15,000 people packing in there, so it'll take a bit to sell it out.
Yeah.
And there's a message for all Bears fans, given that their dream of coming back to the NRL has been knocked on the head this week. Why not get out to the ground at least and celebrate the home ground? But I think it'll be
Ben knows I hate other sports creeping into the show, but anyway,
I think it'll be a
he did it on purpose, I can tell.
I think it'll be a great spectacle, actually. I'm really looking forward to that first day in particular.
Really smart to make it a day-night test. I think even that first round of Shield cricket proved how positive that is at Adelaide Oval. 3,000-4,000 people turning up to the Sheffield Shield, because you can pop up after work, so all those people in North Sydney can pop in. People could even cross the bridge.
Let's hope they use the right pitch.
Cross the bridge.
Yeah.
It's crazy talk.
The right pitch, did you say?
Yeah, the wrong pitch could see the game abandoned potentially. So just pick the right track out there.
Very controversial. A little tabloid in the back seat there, Ben.
Yeah. Well, listeners.
It's getting very hot in here.
Well, Pete and Ben, thanks so much for coming on the podcast this week.
Thanks for having us, Menace.
Yeah,
it was great.
It's stopped raining now.
So. Yeah.
Maybe the cricket will get back on. Listeners, we're going to take a short break, and then I will be back with Nicole Bolton, the Australian women's opener.
Is she in the boot?
You're listening to Cricket Unfiltered, the News Corp cricket podcast, and we're very happy to be joined by the Australian women's opening batsman, Nicole Bolton. Nicole, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
It's an absolute pleasure. Tell me, how has the Ashes been going so far?
Yeah, it's been a really full-on experience so far. Obviously, there was a lot of nerves heading into that first one day in Brisbane, such a big build-up, and obviously with a lot of crowds coming to our games, which has been really exciting. And now, obviously, changing, heading into a test series, which I think the girls are really looking forward to.
Yeah, have you actually enjoyed the cricket out there?
Yeah. I think it's been fantastic at the moment. You know, obviously both teams are going pretty hard and looking to win the Ashes. And I think England, obviously getting that one back against us in the third one day, really, I guess, puts a lot of emphasis on the test match. And there's a lot up for grabs.
Yeah, you and Elisa Healy were cruising in that third ODI against England. Do you feel that the team maybe let that one get away a little bit?
Yeah, I think it was a bit disappointing result in the end. Obviously, Elisa was batting amazingly well, and to get such a good start, none down, and really put England off the back foot, that was exactly what we were after. And obviously after the rain delay, we lost a couple of quick wickets, and then the run rate sort of just took over, and I guess it was a pretty disappointing finish from us, particularly when we started so well, and I guess for myself at the top of the order, another start, which is not what you want. I think once you get a start at the top, you really need to go on for it, and hopefully I get an opportunity to do that in the test match.
Yeah, probably someone needed to score a ton if you were going to chase that total down.
Oh, definitely. I think if it had been either Healy or myself to bat through that entire innings, I think we would have got it quite easily, probably two overs before the 48th, I would have thought. But, you know, as is the way in limited overs, as soon as you lose a couple of key wickets and new batters are coming out, having a score at seven and a half and over, it's a pretty tough gig.
Yeah. Now, has anything surprised you about this English side that's come out here?
I think the fact that they've brought in Ecclestone, who's the left-arm offie, I think she's been a really great addition to their bowling lineup. Obviously, we've been exposed to Brunt and Trubsole in previous Ashes series and throughout WBBL, so we're getting to know a few of their bowlers quite well. But obviously, Ecclestone was a bit of an unknown. We hadn't come up against her before, but you know, now we've had two games against her. So if she is picked in the test series or the games moving forward, we feel pretty comfortable that we've got a game plan suited to combat her.
Yeah, and has there been much banter out in the middle between the two sides, or is it still staying pretty friendly?
Yeah, it's still, I guess, we're probably looking to ice each other out a little bit. Obviously, Heels has said a little bit behind the stumps, but just friendly banter, nothing malicious at all. But yeah, I think the game's been played in really good spirits. It just goes to show how much, you know, an Ashes means to both these teams. And I think we're looking to play some really good hard cricket in the four-day format.
Do you spend much time with the opposition off the field, or do you sort of keep your distance? Because I know you've obviously all played with a lot of each other in different leagues.
Yeah, it's a really unusual experience because obviously I've played WBBL with Catherine Brunt for a few years now, and just recently Anya Shrubsole. So it probably goes as far to say that we'll say hello when we walk past one another, but you know, there's no catching up or coffees or any of that going on during the series. But I have no doubt come the end of the series, both teams will definitely enjoy a beverage and I guess just sort of reflect on what's been a really tough series.
Yeah, I think that's the way cricket should be played, isn't it? Play hard on the field, but at the end of a series, catch up and have a chat about it. And I know you women's cricketers love your coffees, have a latte and debrief.
Now, yeah, that's exactly right.
Now, Rachel Haynes has come in and taken over the side as skipper. She said she wanted to make her mark on the side. How's the mood in the team? Has it changed from when Meg was skipper? How does Rachel sort of differ?
I think Rach and Meg are quite similar. they're both the sort of players that really want to go out and get the job done themselves and lead from the front. Rach has had obviously a wealth of experience captaining Victoria and then recently moving across and being the vice captain of New South Wales. So she's really well suited to this role, and we'll, as a team, I'm really proud of the way that she went out and batted in that second one day. You know, that just really highlighted the sort of player that Rach is, and I think she's really taken to this new role like a duck to water. And, yeah, I know she's really looking forward to leading this group throughout the rest of the series.
Yeah, she smashed them in that second ODI.
Some of the best hitting I've seen.
Yeah, great, incredible strike rate. What's the coach, Matthew Mott, like? How's he coping with the pressure? He's been with the group a while now, coming off the World Cup campaign. How are things with him this campaign?
Yeah, Motti is, he's a really laid-back sort of guy. You know, he doesn't let the pressure get to him, and that goes to show at how we're training. I mean, he always wants us to go and train and play with a smile on our face and pretend we're that, you know, seven-year-old girl who's just started playing cricket. And I think because he brings that sort of attitude, it really allows us to go out with a little bit of freedom and play the way that we want to play. I know from the World Cup, he's done an enormous amount of work with the rest of our assistant coaches and Tim Coyle and Joe Dawes and making sure we're as best prepared and planned as we can be, particularly moving through three different formats. And I think that's been a massive difference so far this series.
Yeah, I want to look ahead to the day and night test. But before we do that, the great thing about podcasts is we just have a little bit more time. It's just you and me. And I thought I could ask you a couple of questions about the beginning of your career. And I wanted to ask you, what drew you to cricket in the beginning? What, when did you start playing? And, you know, we hear a lot of young girls end up playing with boys, but what's your pathway been into cricket?
My pathway has probably been a little bit of the same initially. Obviously, having two older brothers, they played all sorts of sports, and I guess the only opportunity that I could get involved with them was to play whatever they were playing, and backyard cricket was one of them. And I guess the love for that really started, and I just remember having the ball and the sock on the string. We hung it on our rooftop, and I just used to sit there and just hit balls all day on the sock. And then obviously being from WA, we didn't have a lot of pathways for girls to play cricket at that time, and I was fortunate enough to be involved in the under-19s state rep team for WA, and then as a 15-year-old, and then played some ladies A-grade cricket. And the next sort of progression for me was I was selected to play for the Western Fury as a 16-year-old. So I guess I'm a little bit different because over in WA during that time we may not have had the depth, so I was really lucky to get an opportunity as a youngster and sort of develop at that level at a quicker rate. And then obviously when I did finally get my first Australian cap, I was a little bit older. I was 25, but I think that was the perfect time for me. I felt as though I just started to develop and know my game, and everything felt right, and I really thought that I could make a contribution at that level. And here I am today as a 28-year-old, still living out the dream.
And what is it that draws you to cricket? I know some people love the camaraderie. Some people like the competition. When I played, just wanted to bat all the time. I just could, if you could put me in the nets, I would have batted all day. What is it that draws you to cricket?
I think initially I really loved batting. I just loved having that opportunity to bat all day. But I also like the fact that you get an opportunity to field. So you're never really out of the game. I think sometimes you miss out with a bat, but you still have an opportunity to really make up for it in the field. And I think the fielding is the one thing that I love because it's something that you actually do as a team. You obviously bat and as a team, but you don't really get that real sense of being together. And I think when you get that in the field and you're really working hard to get those 10 wickets, that's where it is for me with cricket, and that's something that I really enjoy doing.
What's been the best moment of your career so far?
Oh, that's a really great question. I think I can't really look past receiving my baggy green 2 years ago in England in the last Ashes series. Yeah, it was something that I, you know, really was looking to aspire to achieve in my career and to be able to do it. Yeah, it was an amazing feeling. And then I've never really played any four-day cricket. And for us to win that test match, it was amazing because the game shifted all throughout the 4 days. And to really put the icing on the cake, to win it in the fourth day was incredible. And it just really set us up for getting the Ashes back.
And what about the toughest moment of your career?
I think the toughest moment for me was my first Australian tour that I got picked for as a 24-25-year-old, and it was an Ashes, home Ashes series in 2013-14, and back they were in the sort of the old point system where the test match was played first because it was worth the most points. It was worth 8, and the test match is actually in Perth, and obviously I was really excited at the prospect of potentially playing in a test match in Perth with in front of my friends and family, and I'd done quite well in a practice match against England, and I guess sometimes you get brought back down to earth, and unfortunately I didn't get selected in that test match, and that was really hard to take because obviously like I would have really loved that opportunity to be able to do that, but I had to bide my time a little bit and just sort of cop it on the chin and make sure that I worked harder and scored more runs so I couldn't be ignored moving forward.
Yeah, how did you pick yourself up after that?
Oh, it was quite devastating, to be honest with you, because whenever it's a match that's in your home state, there's a lot of build up and a lot of media hype, and they get around the homegrown girls, and I think you kind of start to believe that maybe you're going to play. And I guess for me, it was such a quick turnaround from the test match to the one day is that I really had no other option but to be disappointed, to be upset, but bring myself back together to make sure that I was bringing the best version of myself for the team across the 4 days, because I was named as 12, so I still had an important role to play. And then obviously in the second game of the one day part is when I made my debut, so I guess feeling that heartbreak and then a few games later being able to play for Australia, I guess it just goes to show if you just keep persisting and you need to move on pretty quickly.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I want to ask you if to pick out one teammate that you really respect and why. And I know you could probably pick out 10 of your teammates, but just pick out one for this podcast, that someone that you respect and why you respect them.
Oh, this is a very hard question, but I think it's a great question. Look, I really respect Rachel Haynes. I think the story of Rach is such an interesting one, and I think all young girls looking to take up cricket should really look at Rachel's career and see that she has gone through a lot of adversity, missed selection, ran drinks, but to get to where she is now, she's worked exceptionally hard. She's copped it all on the chin, and we're just really excited that she's back within the group and obviously leading this group. And I just think it's an amazing story. And, yeah, I mean, she's a couple of years older than me, and I sort of look at her and go, doesn't matter what age you are, if you're good at what you do, the rest will take care of itself.
Yeah, very good answer and very diplomatic answer, if she listens. All right, so thank you so much. Let's have a quick look ahead now to the day-night Ashes test. Is the playing group really excited about making history and playing the first ever Ashes day-night test?
Oh, so excited. I think the group, we picked up our whites last night, and obviously we've been using the pink ball at training and just seeing the pink, I mean, so just seeing the white pads and everything. It's got a great feel about it. Obviously, it's going to be an amazing 4 days of cricket. To play a day-night test in Sydney, sort of have to pinch yourself. It's not something you get that opportunity to do ever. Hopefully, to be a part of that, I know everyone's just really excited to get over to Sydney and to get it started.
Yeah, it's a pivotal match in the series, isn't it? If you can win, you'll retain the Ashes. But if England win, then they're right back in the series. So there's a lot of pressure going into this match.
Yeah, definitely. I think we've given them a little bit of a sniff from that last one day, which just means that this test match means a hell of a lot for both teams. There's a lot riding on it, and both teams will be definitely going out there to actually win the game. And, you know, that would be amazing if on day four we were sitting there after a nice test, hard test series win, retaining the Ashes. I think that's where we want to get to, but we know we've got a lot of work to do between now and then to hopefully get the result that we want.
Yeah, and how have you found the pink ball so far? Has it been swinging around a lot? And I know you wear glasses when you bat. How do you find picking up the pink ball?
It's really different. It does swing around a little bit, and it tends to swing more the fuller the delivery. And on the ball, it's got quite a pronounced seam. So I know a couple of the bowlers are saying they quite enjoy having that pronounced seam because it means that they might get something off the wicket. So as a batter, I think it's going to be quite pivotal in that first session, first 10 overs against the new rock to really knuckle down and really track the ball, being really positive, leaving well. And obviously, as an opener, it's something that I really pride myself on. And in Test cricket, you know, there's no pressure to score quickly. You can really get yourself in, and during those middle overs, you can cash in.
Yeah, I think there's going to be an incredible amount of attention on this game. How have the team and how have you personally coped with the added attention that's been on these Ashes? It's, I mean, unprecedented levels of coverage.
Yeah, it's been incredible, really. It's great to see the Australian public getting involved and getting around this team in this series. I know heading into that first game in Brisbane, I was really nervous, and I've just been in a World Cup, but I would say that that week and that day was a bit of a blur, I guess, because it's a home series and more people are watching and they know what you do. And I think everyone was quite happy to get over the line in that game and get the nerves out and move on pretty quickly. And I think we've just sort of embraced it now. We really love playing in front of our home crowd. And to be on the main channel and people watching and coming up to you, it's really new for this group. But I think there's only one way to be able to deal with that. And we've just sort of embraced that. And they're really excited to take on that into the Test match as well.
Well, I think the Australian public have embraced the Australian women's cricket team this year. So thank you for your fine performances, and thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I know you're in the middle of a busy preparation, so thanks for giving us some of your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Johnson delivers. Anderson spoons it in the air and is caught at short leg. Australia reclaims the Ashes at the Wacker. There is a jubilant 11 Australian players hugging on the pitch in Perth.
Welcome back to Cricket Unfiltered, the News Corp cricket podcast. I now have on the line a man that stormed onto the domestic cricket scene, scoring centuries in both innings of his first-class debut and then a century in the Shield final that year. Welcome to the show, Travis Dean, the Victorian opening batsman. How are you, Travis?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me on.
Now, how's the mood in the Victorian camp? I know you lost the first game, but you're going for, what, four Shield titles in a row. How's the mood in with the boys?
Yeah, obviously it was a disappointing result last week, but yeah, we see it as a positive. We get another chance this week against South Australia, bit of a final replay of last year and the year before. So we have a pretty good contest against South Australia, which yeah, we're all looking forward to, and we're looking pretty confident at the moment.
Good, good. Now, I spoke in the introduction that 2 years ago you made centuries in both innings of your first class debut. Not only were they centuries, but they were unbeaten centuries. There's only six people that have done that in the history of first class cricket, and the only other Aussie is Arthur Morris. So after a debut like that, how do you keep your feet on the ground?
It was pretty easy, to be honest. I just come in and try to hope for the best, and you know, the results, you know, obviously were they end up working out for me. But when I walked into the game, it wasn't my goal. My goal was just to get off the mark, really, and just try my best. To get the centuries on debut was a great achievement, and I think you respect it a bit more as you keep playing. It's a lot harder as your career goes on and people start to figure out a bit more, and you're a bit part of the system, and everything starts to just fall into place. After that, you know, just try and stay as level as possible and just be consistent at every level that you play, whether that's your club cricket, and try and have the same process at the end of the day.
Yeah, has being a professional cricketer lived up to the expectations you had?
Coming in, it's a lot different to working on a golf course, that's for sure. But definitely, it's a great life, to be honest. You get to go in and do something that you love every day, and can't wait to get to work and work on things that you want to achieve for your career going forward. Because as everyone says, you know, it's only a short period that you're going to be a professional sportsman for. You want to make most of it.
And has anything surprised you since you've been playing first class cricket?
Probably just how driven that everyone is, really, that surrounds you, and how willing they are to help everyone else. Obviously, you know, it's a team sport and all, but we're at a domestic level and everyone's achieving for greater honours. But everyone just treats it as it is. We're all teammates. We're pretty close with Victoria. Everyone gets along really well and, you know, shares a lot of information and just enjoys each other's success. That's the main thing.
Was it a welcoming dressing room when you came into the first class then? You know, did you feel part of the setup straight away?
Yeah, definitely. With such a mature group, it was a lot easier to walk into a mature group as opposed to everyone, you know, walking around on eggshells, not knowing where their spot was. Everyone was pretty well cemented, and we had a decent team. My first game, so yeah, everyone was really welcoming, and they sort of looked at me, even though I wasn't really young, they looked at me as one of the young guys and tried to help me out and just ease me into the system.
Now, you spoke about, you know, having higher honours, you know, everyone looking for higher honours at first class level. You were sort of touted as opening the batting for Australia last year at times. How do you put that sort of speculation out of your mind?
Oh, to be honest, you don't really think about it. It's great to be mentioned, but a lot of the time I think you know where you're at personally, and you know realistically that there's a lot of guys ahead of you, so you just keep your head down and you just go about your business, everyday business, and just stay in the moment, really. Like, I don't think that sort of stuff, someone mentioning your name in test selection doesn't make you a good player, really. You know, just you got to keep performing, and if you keep knocking down the runs, that's when you start to realise that maybe you're a chance. But until you do that, you just stick to your process and things will happen for you eventually.
A little bit like keeping your eye on the ball.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, who have some of your strong mentors been within the Victorian team?
Well, when I first came in, I opened the batting with Robert Quiney. He was massive, like up the other end with me. He was unbelievable and really just eased me in and teaching me what to expect and always being on and, you know, planning leading up to games. And also we had David Hussey as our batting coach for my first two seasons, and you know, he was unbelievable and just backing yourself and believing in your own ability. But lately it's been, once Rob and Dave Hussey have left, it's really turned to Cam White. He's one of the older players now. And Lachlan Stevens, he's our assistant coach. So he's sort of taken over as the batting coach role. Like, he's been really good and taken over from what Huss was working with us last year. And Kat, as I mentioned, Cam, he was a big help in me expanding my game and finally getting a one-day call up this year. So, yeah, just working with those guys and trying to tinker my game but try and harness what I've got at the same time.
Yeah, and I guess what are some of those challenges that you're setting for yourself for this season?
Well, at the moment, just try and be consistent in Shield cricket. That's the main goal. As an opening batter, you're big keen how we start off the season. And if you can absorb a lot of pressure early, it makes it a lot easier for everyone else going forward. And we've got a pretty stacked middle order. So guys like Maxwell, Finch, Christian Hanscom, make it a lot easier for those guys. But yeah, it'd be good to just be as consistent as possible and hopefully improve on last year's performances. Everyone likes to make hundreds, but that's not the main goal. Hopefully they will come, but you just stick to your process, really.
Yeah, and what about some of your teammates, some of them Australian representatives? What do you pick up off someone like Pete Hanscom or Glenn Maxwell?
Just their professionalism, really, that they bring back to the group, and what they, you know, a lot of the time it's what they need to do to get ready. It's not always about, you know, toeing the line and doing all kinds of things. Sometimes it's only a 20-minute hit, but you just got to get your eye in the nets and work on things that you've been working on with the coaches. Maxwell's confidence is unbelievable, just the way that he comes out and he plays his shots. You know, you take a little bit from that. Obviously, you don't want to take too much because that's his game, not mine. But, yeah, just the way he believes in himself and he believes in everyone's game individually is a pretty good trait to have.
And how has Pete Hanscom taken to the Victorian captaincy, and did he blow up after the first loss?
No, not really. Pete's pretty calm and collected, as most people would know. He's pretty relaxed. Yeah, he was pretty basic in his debrief. He just said, you know, what's done is done. We all know as the game goes on, 4 days is a long time, so we had a lot of time to debrief throughout the game. And he just said, next game's on next week. Let's worry about that. Forget about, learn from what we did and just move on. Yeah, but he's pretty relaxed in his approach.
Excellent. All right, Travis, now I want to ask you a couple of questions about the Australian cricket scene, putting a first-class cricketer on the hot seat, and everybody's getting stuck into the Bombies. So for a start, are you going to get to any of the Ashes tests?
Yeah, hopefully I'll get to the Boxing Day test. I normally go at least one day of that, so maybe day three. I'll probably get down to the Boxing Day test and have a look.
And have you heard of half of the Pommy team? I mean, we've got Jake Ball, Ben Foulkes, Mason Crane, Dawid Malan or Craig Overton. A lot of Aussies have never heard of them. Are you a big cricket watcher and have you heard of these players?
Yeah, well, you get some pretty cold, lonely nights in Melbourne, so you tend to watch a lot of the English summer. Yeah, I heard of a few of them, yeah. Most of the players have played. Like Malan, he got a go last year, the back end in the middle order, and he peeled out a couple of 50s. He started to find his feet towards the end of the summer. Who else was it? Jake Ball, he's a pretty handy player. So you can't underestimate all these guys that they've named, although I reckon that they don't know what their best 11 is yet. I think both teams are in the same sort of battle at the moment. They're still trying to find some spots, but at the end of the day, they're stacked with good players, so are the Australians. So I think either way, it's going to be a great contest.
Yeah, what's your prediction for the series? Is it going to be another 5-0 Australian victory, or are we going to see a closer contest?
As much as I'd love to say 5-0, I'm not too sure. I think it'll be pretty hotly contested, and I think it might be a bit tighter this season as opposed to the seasons gone by.
It augurs well for the Boxing Day test. The series might still be alive. All right, now, who's your favourite batsman to watch, current or all-time?
Oh, well, currently you can't go past David Warner, especially as an opening batsman. Just love the way that he takes the game on, whether it's first over or, you know, 20th over. He just plays the way he plays and makes it exciting for all the fans out there. Back when I was a younger kid, obviously Ricky Ponting was at the peak of his powers, and Adam Gilchrist, they had a stacked lineup, so pretty much watching anyone. But Ponting was unbelievable how he'd come out one for none and do the same thing. He'd just counterattack. He was unbelievable to watch.
Yeah, amazing player. All right, now I'm on a little bit of a campaign, and I was wondering, do you think Big Bash matches should be played on Christmas Day? I'm taking a survey of all domestic cricketers.
Well, as someone that's not involved in the Big Bash, I'd love to see it on Christmas Day. It'd give me something to watch. But as speaking to a few of the players, I don't think that'd be such a good idea for them. I think they just need a bit of a break on Christmas Day. We've got the game on Boxing Day. I think the Perth Scorchers always get the Boxing Day game. So after the Test match, they come on. So I think that's probably enough. Give them a day off. That'd be fine.
Yeah, I guess my thing is though, they're always travelling around, even on Christmas Day, you know, flying in and out of venues. So Christmas Day is not really a day off for the Big Bash players. So I think they should do it. But like you, I'm not a player. I just get to sit and relax and watch it.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, a lot of great players missed out on selection in the opening round of Sheffield Shield cricket. There's been talk that there should be a 7th Sheffield Shield side, perhaps from Canberra. What do you think of that concept?
Well, with the concept like they've got in the JLT Cup with the CA11, I don't think it'd be too bad of an idea if you're talking about playing the best players in the competition. You know, you don't want too many of the good players missing out come round one pushing for selection. But for some people are going to be traditionalists and they like the 6-state concept, and it's been like that for 100 years. But I think with times, maybe there's in the future, there's room for another team. You know, New South Wales, even WA, have got such good squads at the moment that they probably could have second teams the way that they're going. But then with injuries, who knows? So it'd be something for the board to look at, I reckon. They'd have all the stats on it. So it's probably best left up to them whether it goes ahead or not.
Yeah, I think it's perhaps something they should look at for the future. How do you find the pink ball? It's changed from last year even a little bit. You played with it in the opening round. How do you find the pink ball to face, and, you know, has it changed from last year, the way it behaves?
Not really. No, it hasn't changed the way it's behaved. Like, they did mention that the seams are a bit tighter. They've tightened the seams up so they don't get as soft. Look, we obviously didn't bat long enough in our game to see the difference. It's fine to face. I think it's fine to face as a batter. I'm not sure what the bowlers think of it. I haven't really got around to speaking to the bowlers about it. But more the issue is fielding some of the time. If you're square of the wicket in sort of a dusk period, it's quite hard to see square of the wicket, especially at the Gabba as we played on the weekend with all those funny seats in the background. It's a bit harder. Yeah, around the grounds, it just you'd have to talk to everyone. But just personally, and as a team, we found it a bit more difficult the squarer you got onto the wicket.
Yeah, I found it hard to see when you were at the ground, actually. And, you know, I'm a pretty good cricket watcher, so you know where the ball should be. And then sometimes you just couldn't quite see it when you're in the crowd.
Yeah, definitely. We had some coaching staff or some high-performance staff say that they were watching and sort of a little period there that it just got a bit tough to see. But as it gets more into the night, it makes it a bit easier. And obviously during the day, it's fine. But it's just, yeah, I don't know. There's just a little period there. I don't know how long or whatever it is, but it just gets a touch harder.
Well, Travis, thank you so much for coming on the Cricket Unfiltered podcast. I like these where I get to talk one-on-one with a cricketer, and, you know, I've got a little bit more time and there's not loads of people sticking mics in your mouth. So thanks so much for coming on. Good luck with the rest of the season. I will say, I think Victoria need to share the Shield titles around a little bit this summer.
No worries. I don't think we agree with that, but yeah, Well, hopefully we have a good season anyway. Thanks for having me on, Andrew, anyway.
Yeah, good luck, and catch up again. Cheers.
Yeah, cheers, bye.
Well, listeners, that's it for Cricket Unfiltered this week. Thanks so much to Pete Lawler, Ben Horn, Nicole Bolton and Travis Dean for coming on the show. Remember, subscribe to the show on whatever app you listen to podcasts on. Rate and review the show, and we'll be back next week with another episode.